Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2026 season. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. In this series of podcasts, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2025, both adult and CYA categories. But we'll also be hearing from some other authors of historical fiction. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a staggering $155,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories and the Reader's Choice Award. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading and writing and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. Imagining the Past is commercial-free. HNSA is a volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation and can only continue to produce the podcast with your support. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation through our secure website. All contributions, great or small, are greatly appreciated. All the Bees in the Hollow is Lauren Keegan's first published novel. But as we'll hear, the worker bees in the hive have been active for many years to produce this sweet novel, long listed for the ARA Historical Novel Prize. Welcome Lauren Keegan to Imagining the Past.
Thank you for having me, Greg.
So I thought we could start off today with you just telling us a bit about yourself and when you started writing and what the hell made you start writing.
Sure. So I started writing quite young, actually. So in primary school, I quite enjoyed writing short stories. And I remember, and this is, you know, showing my age a little bit, it's computers just kind of started to land in primary schools at the time. And I'd sneak away at recess and lunch and work away on some short stories that we'd started
late,
at school.
It was late high school for me. So,
yes. So I was doing that. I was working on little short stories and things at home, and that's kind of what I wanted to do when I grew up. I wanted to be a children's author, actually. So when I played make-believe with my best friend and she pretended to be an actress, I'd pretend to sit at my desk and write stories. And I guess I went through a few different ideas of what I wanted to do when I grew up. And through high school, I dabbled in some angsty poetry and journaling. And then I went off to university and studied psychology. And there was quite a dip in my kind of reading for leisure, but also writing. I was just writing essays and lab reports, and that kind of sucked a bit of the love out of it for a few years there. And then I just kind of came back to the reading and started to read more widely. I started a book review blog, and then I thought, why did I stop writing? And then I sat down and started to draft my first manuscript, which would have been more than 15 years ago now. And that was a YA manuscript. And then I went on to write another 8 manuscripts, 9 manuscripts actually, before my 10th one got picked up for publication.
Yeah, maybe we can get to that in a bit, but I'm just interested, did your friend Angelina Jolie become an actress? Or?
No, she didn't. She okay. didn't.
And what drew you to psychology?
That's a good question. I'd always just been interested in people. And I actually, a close friend of mine at school passed away in my final year of school. And so I was kind of experiencing my first kind of real, it's my first real experience of grief outside of kind of grandparents. And I just felt quite, I guess, alone in my experience. And it made me think about like maybe that there's a bit of a gap of having kind of somebody to talk to about what was going on, and that kind of quite interested me. So I initially went into psychology wanting to work with children and adolescents, but I ended up going back even further and working with parents with infants in that really early intervention kind of space. And that's kind of where I've sat for the last 15 years, is in that area.
So you mentioned that you have written a fair few novels, and All the Bees in the Hollow is the first one that you've published. So it sounds like you had a bit of a long and winding road to publication. Maybe you could tell us a bit about that and what sustained you, you know, on this arduous journey, and what provided you the bridge over troubled waters in the end.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, I always think, you know, if any other career, if someone was trying for 15 years and failed to kind of get their first job, you'd think they're a bit delusional. But for some reason,
thanks for that.
Writers just kind of dick at it, right? I don't know. So yeah, I wrote 9 other manuscripts, all various genres. So I dabbled in YA, romance, crime. I wrote a few thrillers. And then the idea for All the Bees came to me, and that was a historical book. So I think what kept me going was that I loved writing. There were certainly so many times where I'd have something out on submission, I'd get all the rejections back in, and I would be thinking, like, should I do this again? Like, why do I keep doing this, investing all this time and energy into creating these worlds and writing these stories? But then like a new shining idea would come along and I would just sink myself back into it. I think I felt like I was always moving forward though. Like I was always seeking feedback and wanting to learn and grow. And I think I was very lucky that no one along the way said, Lauren, you suck, stop doing this. There was always just like this, just enough for me to feel like there was something there. I just had to keep working on it. And like, I do see myself as a self-taught writer. Like I have worked at it for 15 years. And all those manuscripts that I haven't got published, I feel like were really good practice in knowing how to write a book and finish a book and what works and what doesn't.
Where I live in Sydney, we were noticeably absent of bees last year, which everyone in the suburb was kind of commenting, and I'm not sure whether it happened because where I live there are a lot of older Italian couples, and a lot of them do actually keep bees. So, and we often had those blue ones, those ones with the blue bum, and nothing. We had even the little native ones, not this year. So Geraldine Brooks told me that if she hadn't been interested in horses, she probably wouldn't have picked up on the idea that eventually became horse. So Where did your interest in bees come from before you started the novel?
Well, I had already been thinking about writing something about bees because I was spending a lot of time in my garden with my daughter, who was not quite a toddler yet. So she was a little bit late to walk. So I was still carrying her around the yard quite a lot. And I live on a quarter acre block. So we've got quite a lot of gardens. And we would just be like, there was lots of bees in that season. And we were just going around looking at them. And I was already thinking about, oh, should I write a children's story about bees or a chapter book about bees? And then visiting a few friends in the city one time, I was making the trek back down south where I live, and my friend said, oh, there's a podcast episode on bees, which is really interesting. It's a kids science podcast. Why don't you listen to that on the way home? I said, okay, yeah, cool, love bees. And popped it on, and it was only about 8 or 10 minutes episode. And on the episode, they invited a Lithuanian woman to talk about bees and their culture. And I was so engrossed, like way more engrossed than my children were in this episode, because she talked about, firstly, the beautiful folklore around bees. So there was this bee goddess named Ostea. So she told this beautiful story about that. She also talked about how the traditional beekeeping communities in Lithuania worked like their own little bees in a hive. They had their own regulations and quite a close way of working together and a really close connection to nature. And thirdly, they had some beautiful, they have still some beautiful language where their love of bees and honey is intertwined. So a couple of the words that kind of stayed with me. One was the word bitter, which means bee. The word for friend is bitulus. So the word friend is derived from the word bee. So it's kind of quite ingrained in this kind of friendship and relationships and communities. And I think I listened to that and I thought, this is, there's just something there. And I guess I was already primed to hearing something about bees anyway. And I went to listen to it again. And as soon as I went home, I started looking up this bee goddess, firstly, which there was very little kind of original sources around that. But by then I was already on this rabbit, down this rabbit hole of looking at the traditional beekeeping communities in Lithuania and the folklore and the language, and it all just kind of began from there.
When I used to write, I used to think it was fabulous that you had your antenna up for something and the world would just start providing this information. Like at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'd turn the television on and there was something that was exactly what I needed. It's quite
You
strange.
needed.
So is you've kind of mentioned this, but is All the Bees in the Hollow your first novel of historical fiction?
Yes, it is. And I hadn't really thought I would write historical because I've always felt a bit intimidated by the genre because it's so hev like relies on so heavily on research, and I don't think of myself as a very detail-oriented person. I'm more a big picture person. And I just didn't think I could tackle it, I guess. But the story was, I felt so strongly that this was a story I wanted to tell. And I felt quite excited by all the layers and themes that I could draw on using the folklore in that era as well, that I just had to give it a go.
Yeah, maybe we can talk about the research later, but I just I'm interested in that shift from writing other genres to writing historical fiction. What kind of, I'm talking about the actual writing. What kind of problems did that pose, and what were some of your solutions with them?
Yeah, I mean, firstly, I had to really know the world. And I guess previously I'd written contemporary novels and I could, I kind of, I know contemporary life because I live it. But I felt like I couldn't really start anything until I had a bit more of a visual of what life would look like. So it required a lot more thinking and research than any other novel I've written. I am a bit of a pantser, so I tend to just get an idea in my head and then I just start with it. But this, I couldn't really do that with this book. I needed enough to get me started. But I do think that writing in so many other genres and learning the rules for those, it kind of helped me. And I guess, All the Bees in the Hollow, yes, it's historical, but there's also a mystery in it. There's like a very soft thread of romance. There's some folklore, and I think I've just pulled all the things I like from all the different genres into, under the umbrella of historical. And I think that really helped me with in terms of structuring and kind of being able to create the book in the way that I did.
Yeah, it is. I'm just reading a manuscript for someone at the moment that's science fiction, which is not a genre that I enjoy at all. And but it's so similar to historical fiction in terms of having to carve out a world. So you've kind of mentioned this, but what prompted your interest in Lithuania exactly? And have you been there? Do you speak the language at all? Or was that did that make the research hard?
It did make the research hard. I couldn't travel there because it was when I was drafting the manuscript, it was kind of one of our kind of COVID lockdowns. I had two young children. I was homeschooling one child. I had a toddler at home. We couldn't leave the country, let alone our homes. So I couldn't travel there. So I did rely quite heavily on research. And there were some barriers because there wasn't much in English that I could access, but also the time period being the mid 1500s, there was actually very little documentation anyway. And in fact, I think the first kind of published book in Lithuania was at about that time. So there wasn't really much written history. So I did reach out to sources in Lithuania at the time, and that was really invaluable. So firstly, I got in touch with a beekeeping museum in Lithuania, who were probably a bit quiet at the time because of COVID. And I think the contact didn't speak English, but they put me in contact with a friend who worked there that spoke English. And I just explained what I was doing. And this is the first time I'd ever reached out to anyone and said, hi, I'm researching a book. And I think they were just so happy to share their love of beekeeping and their culture that they sent me everything from their museum. So they sent me this huge database of all the photos of all the exhibitions within their museum, which had all the little placards of all the descriptions of the tools and different folklore. But then they also sent me all the audio recordings of their tour through the museum. So I had all this English translated material to work with, and the museum is set kind of in the town where I've loosely set the book, because I used a lot of the local law and beekeeping methods, I guess, to that area. So that was really helpful. And then in terms of the folklore, I reached out to there was an institute of folklore in Lithuania, and spoke to an academic there, and they sent me some translated papers. So that was really helpful as well. So I couldn't travel there, but I think if you can access those kind of real sources, and then obviously just a ton of other research as well.
It's amazing. I always found, like, when you asked people, they would come up with the most amazing things. It was just a matter of asking, really.
Yeah.
When I was growing up in Hobart in the 60s, I had friends from Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, which was quite a feat, I think, for Hobart at that time. Lithuania seems a kind of an interesting place in that it wasn't colonized by the Romans, so it must have given it quite a different history. And it's interesting too that the language has Latin roots, because it just evolved from Latin, but it doesn't have the kind of Romanesque overtone to it. So perhaps you could just give us a bit of a potted history of Lithuania, because I think it's kind of one of those things a lot of people don't know a lot about.
I think the thing that stood out for me is what I learned in the research was that it was the last European state to be Christianized. So I think they tended to maybe go under the radar a little bit in terms of those more kind of traditional or pagan kind of beliefs, maybe sifted through a bit later than some of the other surrounding countries. And that was quite an interest to me in the research. And I would have liked to avoid writing about religion and politics, but as I kind of delved deeper and deeper into this, to the research, I realized I had to kind of incorporate this into the story, because these people would be even in an isolated forest in Lithuania, they were still being influenced by these external kind of pressures. And so that's something that I drew on in the story, is this kind of tension between the old beliefs and the, I guess, the pressure to adopt Christian beliefs, and how some people kind of held on to the old ways, but others adapted, and then, you know, the younger character in my book, Astea, she kind of takes on a blend of both. So that was something that really interested me, and that there were still kind of witch trials and things like that that happened. People were still being arrested, but it seemed to be almost a century later than kind of the other European countries. They seemed to kind of get away with it for a little bit longer, I think.
I read it while I was on holiday in Bali, and we were invited to go to a festival of Kuninyang, which is a Balinese Hindu festival. And I really felt this, we were the only whiteys there. you know, to the point that I felt like we shouldn't be there, but they were quite welcoming. But there was this clash of, you know, the people driving these huge ram cars alongside the, you know, the puppets that were celebrating this festival. So I really felt that clash of old and new that you were kind of visioning in your novel. It was quite funny. So the novel's told through two points of views that are both in present tense. I think one's in first person and one's in third person to kind of demarcate them. So what kind of process did you go through to make those choices that you needed the two voices? And I'm always interested in why people write in present tense.
Yeah, I've just kind of landed in present tense. And I think I started with third person in previous manuscripts. And I think as I moved towards more thriller writing, I went to more like kind of present tense. I liked the immediacy of it. And I don't know, I just kind of still sit there. And I guess I wanted the story to feature two women because in my research, I discovered that unlike, you know, most communities of the time, women could inherit assets. They could inherit the tree hollows from a husband or father, whatever, whereas usually that would go to the next male kin, at least during that time period. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And another thing I discovered was that young women who were wed could stay with their family and have their husband move into their home. So they also got to kind of keep their home and the tree hollows that the family manage. And I thought that was also interesting. It's quite different. So I guess that was my starting point, is I wanted to start the story with this mother and daughter inheriting the hollows. So the father and husband has passed away, which is not a spoiler because it's the first chapter. And I wanted that to be the beginning of change in for the mother and daughter, but also for this kind of tight-knit community. And Austea, the teenage daughter, her voice came to me quite easily. And I can't say why I chose present tense. That's just where I landed, and that seemed to work for her. Marite, I decided to go with third person because I wanted there to be a little bit of distance between her and the reader because of things that happen in the story a bit later on. So I wanted the reader not to necessarily know everything that was going on for the mother in the story. And I suppose the way I wrote it was just alternating views. Like I just wrote it in a linear way with alternating.
All right.
Views. Yeah.
So you didn't write one story and then the other story and try and fold them together?
No, although I'm trying to do that with a manuscript now. It's quite tricky. But because it's the same time period, timeline, it was easier just to switch point of view as I was moving forward. Yeah.
Yeah, the timeline's consistent. But were there any other problems? Had you done that before, had two points of view or multiple points of view? And if this was the first time, were there any particular things that you had to juggle to kind of make them fit together?
I think I have written multiple viewpoints before, probably not more than two. I think that the challenge was to make sure that their voices were quite different. And so for me, I played around with the first few chapters for months before I moved forward because I just needed a good sense of who they were. And when I have a sense of who the character is, the plot kind of flows much more easily for me because then I think about what do they need, what's the worst that could happen to them, how do I make that happen. So I really wanted the mother and daughter to be two very distinct people. So for Marite, she's a very stoic person. She's a very dedicated beekeeper. She likes to follow the rules. She likes structure. She likes to be in control. And then to offset that, we've got Austea, who is a little bit kind of wild, loves to be in the forest, not so keen on all the rules and not even really keen to be a beekeeper either. And so thinking about when there's this change in the community, how does that affect the mother who doesn't like change and like likes to be in control, but also the daughter who maybe wants some change, but it might mean, you know, sacrificing things for her family. So really just wanting distinct voices and characters so that they didn't feel the same.
Yeah, it's quite a challenge, though, when you've got an historical novel in another language, in another time, and you have to find ways to represent the older language and the foreign language in English. I mean, there are a couple of Marités. I found her voice quite modern in terms of there's one where she said Marité cringes as her knee jars on the rope. It has become quite the bother, which is quite a modern expression. So I'm just kind of wondering how you dealt with, you know, that, like, of representing this old language, old foreign language in what has to be kind of modern English, or a modern reader is just going to close off.
Yes, I did make a conscious decision to have a more modern kind of language in the story, but to kind of ground it in some original language, so using the Lithuanian words for mother, father, grandmother, and some of the folklore as well. But I didn't want the reader to be stumbling over clunky old ways of speaking. I wanted the reader just to be able to follow the story but still feel like they were in that old world at the same time.
Yeah. One thing I used to try and convince myself of was that anyone who in any situation is speaking a modern version of that language, so therefore I kind of felt licensed to use a fairly modern version of English, like contractions and things. I mean, jargon obviously is another level of distance. But so you mentioned that you're a bit of a panster. I'm just kind of wondering how that works, because I was never able to do that. I always had to have a really rigid plan before I started. Maybe that was my error.
Yeah, it's kind of, I've always been like that. I actually find if I sit down and try to plot, I just go blank and I feel really overwhelmed and I don't know what I'm doing. And then I'll be pulling out all my books of three act plot, like structures. And I find it very overwhelming. And it's probably something I more do after I've drafted, just to make sure everything's there. But I think having written 9 other books before this one, I think I had, like, it was ingrained in me that the structure of the book. So I kind of knew that at particular times in the story, things needed to happen to keep the story momentum going. So I guess for me, I find it hard to plot. I really am driven by the characters. So I'm really thinking about, you know, for the quarter way in, or the halfway in, or near the end, like, what's going to happen to this character? Like, where do I want them to begin? Where do I want them to end? And particularly for Marité, I just thought of it. I actually wrote a list of, like, what's the 10 worst things that could happen to her between, you know, the bees taking flight and harvest time, and just try to make some of those things happen to her. So that's kind of how I think about it. And one of the good things with historical is that there is, like, an underlying structure. So I started in the mid-1500s, and I chose that time because there were some new regulations that came in around bee hollows being registered by the state and much more regulated and monitored. So there was that kind of change that happened. And then I worked with the seasons. So I knew I wanted to begin with the death and it being kind of dreary winter, and I wanted to end with the harvest and them collecting the honey. So I had the seasonal structure to work with, and I knew there were particular things that beekeepers did in each of those seasons. So that kind of underlying my pantsing, I did have a little bit of that in the back of my mind, that I knew that, okay, in winter, this is what they do. In autumn, this is what they do. Summer, this is what they do. And that propelled lots of new ideas of what I could bring into the story. Yeah, so that's kind of how I did it. And to be honest, even after the first draft, I don't think the story structure really changed much at all, really. It was more at a sentence level that I was continuing to add layers and depth.
Yeah, I think that's true, that once you've written a fair few novels, that sense of structure is just naturally ingrained. I mean, it's also you watch a movie, you know, you can just feel, you can feel it happening. So, yeah, I'm just interested in going back. You've kind of mentioned this, the glossary of Lithuanian words that you had at the beginning. I understand that you, I mean, I'm just interested in why you use those words when there were adequate words in English. I understand with the beekeeping friend word, I thought that was lovely. But yeah, I just kind of wondered because there was such kind of, it's another step you're asking the reader to take with you, I think.
Yes, and I had readers say they were thankful there was the glossary to come back to. Look, I guess, yes, it is a little bit extra work for the reader. And I guess for me it was just having those kind of clutch words that reminded the reader that you're in Lithuania and not somewhere else. And for me as a reader, like I really love traveling through books. So anything I'm learning new about language or culture, I quite enjoy that. As long as it makes sense, and I don't have to work too hard, I guess, to figure out what they're saying. But at the same time, like I feel like people are intelligent enough to kind of figure stuff out as they go as well. And I kind of like sometimes to kind of not fill in all the gaps for the reader as well. But I did only select a small number of words to weave through the book to ground them in that time and place.
Yeah, there are, I mean, there are novels that take this to such an extent that they become just arduous and alienating, really, I think. Which you mentioned this at the beginning with the, in terms of creating the world for the novel, was that hard or did it kind of just, once you had done the research and you've mentioned the variety of things that you were able to pull together, did the actual world of the novel just kind of come together quite easily?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's set in a quite remote forest, and I think that kind of insular setting I really like to create. And I think once I had a sense of what kind of trees would be around, what's the climate like, what are their religious beliefs, what are the beekeeping practices, like I try to ground it in as much of that factual detail as I could. But like I said, there was very limited sources, which meant that I really just had to think about what would life be like for people in this time living in this forest. And there were quite a lot of documented like folklore and gods and goddesses that people worshipped. And I thought it's probably not that far of a stretch to think that people living as beekeepers in a remote forest, surely they would have, you know, their own goddess or gods around nature and bees that they would kind of worship as well. So once I kind of got into the sense that this is just how, this is their world, they're not thinking of it as folklore, this is just how they see their world, that really helped, I guess, just to be able to move forward with the story. But I think I did have to have quite a clear sense of the setting before I kind of got started to be able to see how the characters interact with that. And so much of the setting is ingrained in the characters, you know, for Marite with the bees and for Osteo the forest and the trees and the weather, that it all relates to each other so much as I was writing. But I think I didn't realise with historical, like you said, you're actually creating like a world. So historically you're creating a whole world in the past that you want readers to step into. And I guess, you know, dystopian, sci-fi, fantasy, it's not too dissimilar to that really. You create another whole world. Yeah. Only ours is, you know, based in some factual grounding, yeah.
Even a science fiction world has to have a set of rules that are consistent and operating. I'm always interested to know what you first wrote and did it survive into the novel?
Good question. My first novel was a YA.
No, I mean with this novel, what was the first thing, what was the first, you know, couple of paragraphs that you wrote for this novel and did they survive?
Good question. I think they might have. So I had begun the first chapter was always a stayer, the death of the father and a stayer. I probably re like at a sentence level, I definitely would have rewritten the first few paragraphs over and over and over. I'd say the essence of it didn't really change, but because I am an underwriter, I have to keep coming back and adding detail and layers to a scene. So that's kind of my redrafting process. I'll have the structure and the essence of the story there, but I have to keep coming back and adding layer upon layer upon layer at a sentence level. That's where I have to work quite hard at. So my very first drafts, I would not want to show anybody because they're just they're terrible, and probably wouldn't reflect the writing of the final copy.
So you're about to release a new novel. Tell us a bit about that, and is it historical fiction?
It is, yeah. So my new novel is called The Woman in the Sealskin, and it's a historical novel that is drawn on by Selkie folklore. So I've kind of gone from bees to seals in this one. And it's set in 1695, so about a century and a half later than All the Bees in the Hollows. Totally different world and characters, but I've just kind of stepped a little bit closer into the past. And it's set on this wild Scottish island amidst the backdrop of Europe's little ice age. So, and it's about a young woman named Marley who has grown up with stories about Selkies. So these women who shed their seal skins to take on human form, and they seduce lonely fishermen. And that's the story of her parents, or so she believes. So she's got this kind of history of that. And her mother has disappeared. And so she's really got her whole life mapped out for her. She's newly married. She's expecting her first baby. But then when her husband and her father return from quite a treacherous fishing voyage, there's this newfound fear that the Selkies have returned, and these so-called Finn men in sea, out at sea have like swept the sea of all the fish. And who are fishermen without fish? So there's all this pressure to survive. And Marley, on this wild island, kind of starts to connect with the wildness within her. So her kind of connection to her mother and her own heritage, and kind of starts to take control back of her own life. So there is actually quite a lot of violence and oppression in the community. And Marley, yeah, I guess really needs to draw on her own wildness to be able to overcome, yeah, all those pressures.
And have you started working on something new as well, or and I'm always interested, are you kind of going to work through your back catalogue, or is that all staying in the bottom drawer?
I get asked that a lot. I think it'll all stay in the bottom drawer. But they were really good practice runs. I might come back to some of those genres. I guess crime. I keep coming back to mysteries and crimes in my stories, whether that would be contemporary or historical crime, I'm not sure. But no, they won't be coming out anytime soon. And I have just finished drafting a third. What would hopefully be my third book, which is a little bit different again. It's a bit more recent history, and it's a dual timeline. So there's a contemporary and a historical thread in the story, but that's still quite early days.
So it must have been quite a rush to be long listed for the ARA Historical Novel Prize. Perhaps you could tell us mere mortals a little bit about that.
I mean, yes, it was a thrill and like so validating. I just think, nine manuscripts that didn't get it anywhere, and probably half of those out on submission to agents, publishers, and got rejected. And then my debut novel is kind of appreciated in this way, like so validating that people saw something in it, I guess. And it is a little bit different. It's not like a, I guess, a traditional historical fiction novel. Like it is a little bit of a genre fluid story with the folklore and the mysteries. And so I just felt really happy, I guess, to have all that hard work, that it's paid off and that it was validated in that way into such a prestigious prize as well, and to be like listed alongside like some incredible authors like Emily Maguire and Robbie Arnott. It was quite surreal actually. And then of course to be invited along to the award ceremony night with all, you know, rubbing shoulders with all my kind of favorite authors was pretty cool.
That's lovely. Well, thank you very much for your time today. I've enjoyed our little chitty chat, and good luck with your new novel.
Thank you so much for having me, Greg. It's been great chatting to you.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2026 season. Please remember to explore our extensive podcast archive, where you'll find a wealth of interviews. I'm Greg Johnston. Keep reading, keep listening. It's so good to have your company, Imagining the Past.